Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. Our guest today is Geraldine Brooks, journalist and author. Where do I begin? She worked for the Sydney Morning Herald and in 1982 won the Greg Shackleton Scholarship to the Journalism Masters Program at Columbia University. Later, she worked for the Wall Street Journal, where she covered the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. Her first novel, Year of Wonders, was an international bestseller, translated into more than 25 languages. In 2006, she was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction for her novel, March. Her novels, People of the Book, Caleb's Crossing, and The Secret Chord were New York Times bestsellers. In 2022, her novel, Horse, was shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize. Geraldine, a warm welcome to Imagining the Past.
G'day.
G'day. I could almost start with Hello Possum now, couldn't I? I'd like to take you back to start with, if I may, to Bland Street in Ashfield in the 1960s. And I'm just wondering, when did you first get the notion that words in all their many forms would be your trade?
I was 8 years old when I conceived a mad, burning ambition to be a newspaper reporter. And I remember that day very vividly. I'd gone, we had an appointment in the city, and my mum said, we should go and you want to see where your dad works. So we went to the old Daily Telegraph building where he was working as a proofreader. And we got there just about when the afternoon edition of the paper was about to go to press, and he took me down to the press floor, and it was just a sensory bombardment. The air was misty with ink and the noise of the linotype machines and the presses started to roll, and the newsprint was just spinning from one side of this cavernous room to the other, and the papers differentiated themselves and landed on the conveyor belt. And Dad reached out and grabbed one and handed it to me. And it was warm. It was hot off the presses. and I looked down at the still slightly wet ink of the headline, and I thought, I'm the first person in the city that knows what's going on right now. And I really wanted to be a part of that. So that was what was on my mind. But books were very important in my family. Both my parents were avid readers, and with my sister, we'd go every Saturday to the local library. The closest one was Enfield. And we'd get the bus there, and we'd get the bus home with our huge stack of books for the week. And my dad read to me until I could read for myself every single night. And yeah, no, books and story were very big, but I wasn't thinking novelist. I was thinking journalist, and that was what I headed towards.
So the journalism, was that just kind of an extension of your father, or you know, what drew you to that specifically?
No, I think it was both parents, but I just became fascinated with the idea of having this absolute license to go and bother anybody about anything. And actually, it's turned out that novelists can do that too. You can get it up in people's business when you want to find out how something works. And so I'm still doing a little bit of that, but not every day and on deadline the way I did for more than a decade.
So just moving forward a lot, what was the first idea you had for Horse? Where did that come from?
Oh gosh, well, this was very fortunate. I became a horse obsessive rather unexpectedly and rather inconveniently at the age of 53, having never had a riding lesson. But I was at a writers' conference in Santa Fe, and they had beautiful horses in the corral right next to the room that I was assigned to. And I was admiring the horses, and one of the wranglers said, "You should come for a trail ride." And I said, "I can't ride." And he said, "Yes, you can." So I went with him, and it was an ecstatic experience. And I just became obsessed with horses. And then somebody offered me a horse. And so I've suddenly got a horse, and I'm learning to ride at the age of 53. And I don't want to think about anything else. You know, I was supposed to be writing a book set in Second Iron Age Israel at the time, and I was suddenly very uninterested in it because there were no horses.
Right.
And I just happened to be lucky enough to be invited to lunch at a museum not far away from here where I'm living now. And at the lunch was a gentleman from the Smithsonian Institution, and he was regaling his luncheon companions with the story of how he'd just delivered the skeleton of the most famous racehorse of the 19th century that had been stuck in an attic at the Natural History Museum in Washington, but had been retrieved to become pride of place in an exhibition in Kentucky on the history of the thoroughbred and why Kentucky was the center of the thoroughbred breeding industry, which all came down to this particular stallion of the 1850s. And I was leaning across the table and my lunch was uneaten, and I realized I had my next novel.
Wow, that's so if you hadn't been had if you hadn't become involved with horses, would your antenna have been up to this story, or would it have just passed you by?
I don't think so. I don't think so. It was because I was thinking about horses from the minute I woke up to the minute I went to sleep. And they're very expensive things, horses. So there was a lot of outgoings with this horse that I'd acquired. There's no such thing as a free horse, you know. And not a lot of incomings because I was going so slowly with my actual day job. So this was absolutely a gift from the gods to be able to devote myself to learning about something that was what I wanted to be thinking about anyway.
The first time I read the novel, it really did feel like you were reveling in the language of horses, that was something, a kind of new palette for you, or a new color for you to put on your palette.
Well, I'm very interested in the history of language and expressions and idioms anyway. And there's so much of what we say that we don't even realize comes from horse-related things. Like when we use the expression winning hands down, that means the jockey didn't raise his whip at the finish line.
Right.
A shoe-in is a fixed race when all the jockeys have colluded to shoe one particular horse in front of them. And it goes on and on, you know, so that was fascinating.
So once you've got this idea about the horse, you obviously then started drawing in other elements to form Jess and Theo and even Martha Jackson. So what were some of the decisions in the process around this? Because, you know, at first glance, it all really doesn't marry up.
I know. And it didn't for quite a long time in the writing either. So I was taking it on trust that it would. But they were all things that fascinated me as I delved into the story of the horse. There was, of course, the incredibly fascinating actual 19th century story of the greatness of this horse, not only the fastest of his generation, but also the most prolific sire of champions ever in the history of racing. And also what happened to the horse during the Civil War, which was extremely dramatic. So that was the spine of the story, but I also was very interested in what the skeleton had been doing at the Smithsonian in the first place, and the science around bones at the Smithsonian Institution, and how they're used in study and who prepares them and all that. So I knew that there'd be a contemporary thread at the Smithsonian. And when I went to the Smithsonian to research what osteopreparators actually do, I also met curator from the art museum who said, you should come and have a look at this oil painting of the horse we've got. And that led me directly to Martha Jackson, who was a contemporary gallerist of the post-World War II period, when abstract expressionism and op art and a whole bunch of movements that were changing our aesthetics were forming. And she was a champion of the most radical artists of her day. But she had this one incredibly traditional oil portrait of a racehorse, which she gifted to the Smithsonian along with her contemporary collection. So I was really intrigued with why somebody who was a committed modernist would have this traditional painting in her collection. So that was a whole other thread to pull.
So from what you're kind of saying, it's a fairly organic process that you, once you've got one thread and start pulling on that, then you find others and they come together.
Well, you know, I believe what Mark Twain said, which is fiction is obliged to stick to possibilities. Truth isn't. And so I believe that truth will always be the most interesting because it's the least predictable. And so I like to follow the line of fact as far as it leads, and only start making things up when the voices fall silent and the record becomes obscure, but follow what can be known as far as you can go. And that's, so when I started thinking about a 19th century racehorse, I didn't know that his story was going to lead me directly to the death of Jackson Pollock, but it did.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things that, you know, historical novelists get flogged about is the fact that there are these gaps in history, you know, these cracks. They almost seem to be the best thing to find for an historical novelist, because you can dream into those cracks and imagine things.
Yes, but I think I'm first attracted to a story that happened that's so implausible that if you made it up, nobody would believe it. So I like to find, it's like you need enough, but not too much. There's this happy spot where you can have the architecture of the story that is true, but you can't know everything, because if you know everything, then it's a job for a narrative historian.
Yeah, but it's like a loom, isn't it? That you set up the threads and then start moving between them is how I kind of feel.
That's very medieval of you. I was thinking more of a construction site where you have scaffolding.
Well, the first one I thought of was a ladder, but I thought I wouldn't go there.
Well, let's not start on that, or we'll be out metaphoring each other.
The thoroughbred racing horses stand on a pretty odd kind of nexus, you know. While debate still rages on about genetic modification, old Harry's eyes had seen the foal that Alice Caneal and Boston could produce. And Jess observes at one point, how could we be so creative and so destructive at the same time? So it seems these horses have been, you know, they're almost human made, these beings, because they're not kind of natural. They've been bred for so long and refined for so long. But none of this would exist without the gambling and the racing industry, and in your story, the exploitation of slaves, to put these marvelous beings into existence, but also they sit on this very odd nexus.
Well, it, you know, I have incredible reservations. I mean, I'm going to just come right out with it. I hate horse racing. My first job in journalism was to be the assistant to the racing writers at the Sydney Morning Herald. And I had to go to every horse race in Sydney. And at first I thought, oh, lovely, I can look at the horses. But I saw so many accidents. And, you know, well, maybe it wasn't even so many, but I saw a couple of really terrible accidents where the horses had to be destroyed. And you know, obviously it's absolutely outrageous in the United States. I think there's something like 22 horses every week die on the track. And here they have all kinds of practices that no other civilized country tolerates, like the use of Lasix, which is a diuretic, which is a terrible thing for young horses, and racing them at such an early age. I mean, any horse person knows that you don't even get on a horse till they're 5. And by the time a racehorse is 5, it's probably been thrown away and sent to Mexico for to be made into dog meat. You know, I just think it's a brutal, inhumane business. And there are a lot of good people in the industry who understand that and are working to change it, but they haven't really succeeded because there's so much money involved. But the thing is, it's costing them money to abuse these animals because now, you know, you're lucky if even a champion horse has 5 wins before it has to be retired because they've been so overbred that their bones are just too fragile. So in the 19th century, it was a very different idea about what racing was. The races were long. They could be even 4 miles long, and they could even horses could even be asked to race 4 miles 3 times in one day. So these horses were bred for incredible strength and stamina as well as blistering speed.
The whole problem with the gambling industry, like I remember when the Gallery Mona was opened in Hobart, and that's basically founded on gambling. Like I remember at uni, Walsh, was banned from gambling at the casino in Hobart
Winning so much.
because of card counting.
He was winning. That's why they banned.
So,
They're a bunch of crooks. You cannot never beat the house.
but
But yeah, no, it's yeah.
The thing is, Mona is basically established on other people's losings. Like he won and he did something noble with it, but he wouldn't have won that money if someone else hadn't lost it. And it's the same with the horse racing industry.
Well, yeah, I mean, we could. I find it incredibly concerning. You know, online gambling is just, you know, even kids are getting into awful debt because it's just become so easy. And these online gambling firms just offer them money to get them hooked on the idea of it. So yeah, no, I think it's just terribly exploitive of the people who often have the least to lose, you know. The least that they can afford to be, you know, losing.
Year of Wonders and March, I think, are fairly, your first two novels are fairly kind of straightforward narratives. But then with People of the Book, it's much more complicated. You've got numerous diverse time periods and voices. Did that mark something of a bit of a liberation for you in your
Oh,
development?
no, it was the opposite. Sorry, Year of Wonders. Was, you know, it was fairly straightforward, and I'd been thinking about it, or I'd been thinking about the situation in Eam before I was thinking about writing a novel about it for 10 years before I sat down to write it. And then I started People of the Book right after Year of Wonders, but I didn't have the chops. I couldn't pull it off. I didn't know how to handle, you know, 5 centuries and as many different continents. And so I had to set it aside, and I thought, oh, got the idea for March, and I thought, oh, that's doable. That's 1 year, one main voice, and you know, off I go. And so I did that, and then I went back and looked in the drawer at what I'd started to do with People of the Book, and the time away from it had allowed me to see clearly what wasn't working and what I needed to do.
Yeah, horse feels in a lot of ways like a continuation of that complexity. So, do you feel like your growth as an artist, how much does one novel inform the next? Are they standing on one another's shoulders in a way?
Sure, really? I feel like the idea speaks to me, and then it tells me, you know, what kind of form it is going to need to take. And the next one that's hatching away now is a linear story, but it's going to cover a very long time period, so that'll be different. And I'm looking forward to the unique challenges of doing that, you know, because the thing is, I don't know if you feel like this too, but when you get an idea for a novel, it's this bright, shiny, beautiful thing, And it's going to be so much easier than the book you're working on that you have to finish, and it's such a slog. And as soon as you get to this new bright shiny thing, it'll be smooth sailing, and it never is.
Yeah, well, the horizon's always calm, isn't it?
It just never gets easier. I think if anything, it gets harder because you realize, my God, people are actually going to read this.
So another kind of parallel with people of the book and Horse is that Hannah is also Australian. In people of the book, I'm just wondering what your ideas were around having these Australian characters of Hannah and Jess.
So to take Jess in Horse first, it was because that I was in a lot of deep water in Horse because I was doing the thing that is quite controversial, which is trying to imagine lives extremely different to my own, Black lives in particular, Black lives in the 19th century, the lives of the enslaved. And I needed to not leave that story of race and injustice in the 19th century as if it was over and done with, given that I had a 20th century story running parallel. I needed that to resonate in the 21st century as well. So I had a lot of research to do and a lot of sitting and talking to people about their lived experience. And I thought, I'm just going to give myself a break here and have one character that I already know.
Well, Burwood Road, where she lives, isn't that far from Ashfield, so.
Well, Burwood Road was where I lived after we left Bland Street.
Oh,
so
okay.
We moved when I was 5 and we lived on Burwood Road, Concord.
Right. So you've kind of hinted at this, that you've got many kind of voices. There's the Afro-American slaves who are contrasted with the Southern slave owners and the Northern artist. And then you've got the modern voices of Theo, Jess, and Martha. How did you arrive at all those voices?
So it's kind of a gradual. I mean, so the one that was the easiest was Thomas J. Scott, the artist, because he also wrote. And he was written about. And so I could feel, I had a real sense of how he sounded. There were letters from Tenbrook, who was the second owner of Lexington. And in his letters, you get a very strong sense of what kind of a guy he was. For the enslaved, that's a lot harder because you don't hear enslaved people speaking in their own voice very often. There are some slave narratives that were written in the period. And so I read those. And also you do hear enslaved people's own words when they're in court, when there's verbatim testimony. And then there is an oral history archive at the Smithsonian that was made in the 1930s where formerly enslaved people were interviewed about their lives. Whoops. We might have to redo that bit.
That's okay. We can cope with the doggy barking.
So I listened to these old recorded interviews just to get some of the idiom and modes of expression that might have been used and that might feel authentic. But it was also important to me, particularly for Jarrett, my main Black character from the 19th century, because the novel follows him from the time he's a youth to his early adulthood, and his life changes quite substantially. So I wanted his diction to reflect that. And so his voice changes throughout the novel. The other voices tend to stay the same.
The court records you've mentioned, how were they actually produced? Because were they just written out by hand as people were speaking?
Yeah. It was like they would have stenographers taking down testimony, going all the way back to the early English colonists, the church courts, that's where you can actually find women's voices, because women in the 1630s typically didn't learn to write. So the only way to find women's accounts of themselves are when they're testifying in court.
Apart from the main stories of Theo, Jess and Jarris, you know, there are these other characters that have their own voices. Like you've mentioned, Thomas J. Scott, Mary Barclay has one chapter, and Martha Jackson. Thomas J. Scott is the only character who's kind of in first person. I'm just wondering why you had him in first person.
Because his was the most accessible voice, because he had written so much. And so I've had a real confidence about what he would sound like.
It does also introduce another texture to the novel, I felt, because there's a shift of point of view.
Yeah, I like to write in first person. It just wasn't possible or feasible for most of the characters to do that in this novel. And I could have done it for Jess, I suppose, but that seemed like it'd be too much like Hannah.
But it also would have, privileged her voice, I think, over Theo's.
Yeah, you're right, it would have. So anyway, I didn't really consider it because I didn't want to fall into the same cadences that I'd used for Hannah. So
Do you, when you're planning and starting to write, do you, you know, write something in third person, then change it to first person to see how it feels? What's your kind of process around that?
No, not really. No, I try and, you know, make that decision because it changes everything. So to me, it'd be unfortunate if you go to all the trouble of working it out one way and then you have to completely toss that.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. I think that's why it's worth trying a couple of experiments in the first, you know, couple of pages.
Oh, I love to give it to writing students as an exercise in a workshop. I think it's incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's much better to get it sorted out before you start, really. So
it's usually pretty clear to me how it has to be. I mean, if it can be first person, I prefer it to be first person.
The opening chapters move pretty quickly through a series of time periods and places and characters. You know, the reader gets the feeling these people are completely separate, but they're kind of subtly linked. And it creates this lovely narrative tension. You know, these people and these situations are connected. I'm not quite sure how. I better read on to kind of find out. But it could have been really quite alienating, I think. I'm just wondering how difficult what all of that was to balance for you.
Well, it was a bit nerve-wracking because I was just taking it on trust that I was going to figure out how to connect them. I mean, yes, they all had a connection to the horse, but it needed to be deeper for the book to work. And it was very, very late in the game when it finally became clear to me that the art was going to be the connective tissue. And once I could see that, then I was able to go back and make that happen. But it took me a long time to figure it out.
The novel, like you've kind of hinted at this, the novel, you were really doing something quite risky. And Theo at one point says, no true portrait of Africans by white artists exists. The white artists couldn't see past their own ingrained stereotypes of blackness. It felt like you were kind of almost provoking a response there or preempting criticism.
No, not at all. I was just, I was trying to think my way into the head of an art historian. And that is a quote from an essay by Frederick Douglass.
Yeah.
That's on Theo's mind as he's looking at depictions of blacks in art by white artists. And I was just thinking that that's the kind of thought he might have had. I really wasn't picking a fight.
But it was, I mean, you really have achieved something quite momentous, I think, with this. So how difficult and how pressing was that on you while you were writing?
Oh, look, I was really worried about it. You'd be a fool not to be. I mean, I think this discourse has been incredibly important, and I think it's had a really salutary effect on publishing. because I think the doors are open wider now to a greater diversity of voices and a greater diversity of people choosing the voices too, because when, like even 10 years ago, you would not see a brown or black face in a publishing house. It was absolutely lily white business. And that's no good because that doesn't reflect the cultures that we live in. So it's been an incredibly valuable argument. I didn't want to be part of it, but once I found out that the success of this horse, and in fact, the racing industry in the 19th century in general, was built on the plundered labor and skills of enslaved black horse experts, I couldn't leave them out of the story. I had to center them, or I had to give up doing the book altogether. It would have been completely cowardly to do the thing that would have been the safe thing to do, which is center the narrative on the white owners of the horse. But I just thought that was unconscionable because you'd be erasing the contribution of these talented men one more time. And I wasn't going to do that. So I just thought I'd just have to do the work and try and get it right. But I was very nervous about how it would be received.
Yeah. I just last week read Melissa Lukashenko's Too Much Lip. And I really had this sense of, you know, this could only have been written by an Indigenous person. And also just, it really was an illustration that we have passed a border now, and there's kind of, this is the new frontier of self-representation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and absolutely essential to hear experiences and voices that are different from our own. But also, I think it would be a very arid landscape if one were not allowed or even encouraged to think outside of your own experience. Because honestly, I don't want to spend my novelistic career only writing about Irish immigrants to Australia, 1860 to, you know, I mean, I want to think about and empathize with people who are different.
There was an interview I remember 1,000 years ago with Joan Armour Trading, where someone asked her if all her songs were about herself. And she just kind of laughed and looked at the interviewer and said, "No one is that interesting."
Yeah, exactly. You know, and when I was in 2011, I had the honor of editing Best American Short Stories, and I had to choose the best of the best out of the culled selection that I was presented with. And I was really dispirited because they were so small bore. They were all, you know, very kind of one room, one family, usually a white family, the anxieties and neurosis thereof. And that is very tedious. You know, I wanted a much broader canvas and a much wider range of voices and a much more daring, imaginative approach.
So as your careers become kind of more brilliant with each novel, I'm just wondering if the editing and the book production process has changed dramatically for you.
I don't think there's anything different in the work. This book, I'm happy to say, has been incredibly well received. So the only thing that's different is it came out a year ago and I'm still on book tour. And that's never happened to me before.
Right.
But I'm still getting slews of invitations to speak about this book. And I feel like, my God, the next one might sink without trace, so I might as well do this.
I think that's unlikely. I was thinking more about the actual editing process and your kind of interaction with the publisher over the text. How has that changed as your voice has become stronger and more complex?
It hasn't really. So I've been with the same editor for almost all my fiction, not the first novel, but all the rest. And he's very good, but he doesn't get the manuscript until it's been through at least three other reads from people I rely on, particularly my Australian mate Graham Thorburn is a fantastic early reader because his professional life has been in film, so he th sees things in a very different way, how you tell stories. And he's invariably has great insights that are very helpful in shaping the text. So by the time it gets to my official editor, it's already been edited. And that's been true for all my work.
A good swathe of our audience, I think, are aspirant writers. So, as beginning emerging writers, we're often in courses, besieged by the rules in inverted commas of writing. I mean, Horse clearly breaks some of these kinds of rules. So, I'm just wondering how you think the novel would have been received by a publisher or an agent if Horse had been your first novel.
That's a frightening thought. I don't think I even want to imagine that. I don't know. My career has been incredibly lucky and not typical at all because I had an agent for nonfiction when I was a journalist. I'd written two books of nonfiction. And so when I decided to try my hand at fiction, I wrote three chapters of Year of Wonders and I gave it to my agent that I already had, and I didn't hear anything from her. And I thought, oh, well, she hated it. It stank. I better get back to my real job. And then I think it was about 6 weeks later, she called and said, I sold your book. So she sold it on a partial, which hardly ever happens. And then, I didn't even know if I could write the rest of it, but I had to sit down and bloody well try because I had the advance. this is not the way it normally goes, and I'm very grateful for that.
So what do like you were shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize last year with the novel. I'm just wondering what these kind of prizes and things mean to you in a general sense and in a specific sense.
Well, I who doesn't love a prize? Prizes are great. No, it's wonderful to be validated, particularly in the kind of good company that you find yourself when you're on these lists. The other books are so great, and they're often books that you've devoured, and you just feel absolutely privileged to be part of that community and to get that kind of recognition. It's really absolutely terrific. Well, it's nice to have historical fiction recognized because it is often, it's kind of a poor relation genre, which I don't think is warranted when you look at how many great novels actually are historical fiction. But not once, when it's a great novel, nobody calls it historical fiction anymore. Like Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, absolutely magisterial work of art. But nobody describes her as a historical fiction writer, that she just becomes a fiction writer. And I just think the genre deserves a little bit more respect.
Well, it does have its own dictates and tropes, I guess. So you've been.
Oh, it doesn't really. It can be anything. It's just set in the past. So many excellent books are just happen to be set in the past.
So you've been traveling a lot of late to the Fernow Islands and Iceland. Is there a literary connection between these islands? What are you working on at the moment?
Flinders Island. Flinders Island is a place I've loved for ever since I first set foot there. And I was researching a novel that I never wrote, actually, that was about Jane Franklin. But I wanted to go back there for personal reasons and just have some quiet time to reflect on things and work on a small memoir that I hope I'll get to finish this year. Iceland, it has a brilliant writers retreat every year. And so I was at the first one 9 years ago, and this year they invited me back. And so I love Iceland. It's as close as you can come to an extraterrestrial experience without leaving the atmosphere.
So they're not linked.
Not linked at all, but I do like islands. I live on an island. I live on Martha's Vineyard. There's something about encountering the water many times a day that just makes me happy.
On the front cover of my edition of Horse, the Washington Post declares that you bring the past alive, but I think arguably you've also brought the present alive. So what were the differences between balancing these two kind of quite disparate time periods? Was that a hard thing to do?
You know, it's fun when you've worked mostly writing about the past to be able to be in the present, because you're just using stuff that you observe yourself. And particularly with Horse, because so much of it was just drawn from the experience of being at the osteoprep lab at the Smithsonian, and talking to the incredibly interesting and weird people who work there. And then just being able to draw on your own thoughts and experience and just give them to your characters, which you can't generally do with your historical characters, or it would, you know, it would break the space-time continuum.
So the novel astutely points out that the questions around race in modern times are, far from resolved. Given the opportunity that in Australia we're facing later this year, and that, we're largely, I kind of feel this, I talk about this with people, and I'm just talking to the choir in a way. So what do you feel like can be done over the next few months to kind of ensure a positive outcome? Because, as I said, we all live in bubbles and speak to a choir, really.
I think we need to appeal to Australia's basic sense of fairness. Like, the Aboriginal community can't be properly reflected in the normal democratic processes because the population of Indigenous people in Australia is so small. Therefore, to make it fair, to make the democracy function as a proper democracy, we need that voice. We need that extra input, and it should be formalized and recognized constitutionally so that it can't be buggered up by some kind of right-wing government that comes along, 6 years or 6 months or 6 decades from now. It should be enshrined. And I think Australians, if they see it as an issue of fairness, will vote the right way. And I can't stand the way it's been politicized by people who've been on the wrong side of every social justice issue in their career.
So just to finish up the today, I'm just wondering, what was the first scene you wrote for Horse, and did it survive to the final edit?
Well, it did. And it was, I just decided to start at the beginning and describe the birth of the foal.
So that was your first writing. Lovely. All right, well, thank you.
If in doubt, chronology is your friend.
Well, Maria von Trapp was right. We have to start at the very beginning. All right. Well, I'd like to thank you for your time today, and I've really enjoyed our discussion. So, and good luck with everything in the future.
Well, thank you, and it was great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.